Ephesians chapter 4, verses 25 through 32. Wherefore, putting away falsehood, speak ye truth each one to his neighbor, for we are members one of another. Be ye angry, and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath, neither give place to the devil. Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing that is good, that he may have whereof to give to him that hath need. Let no corrupt speech proceed out of your mouth, but such as is good for edifying as the need may be, that it may give grace to them that hear. And grieve not the Holy Spirit of God, in whom ye were sealed unto the day of redemption. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and railing be put away from you with all malice. And be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving each other, even God also in Christ forgave you.
Well, I thank Steve for reading that passage, and we will return to that in just a moment for the application of our lesson this evening. But we are again in 1 Samuel chapter 25, where we have studied three lessons previously, 1 Samuel chapter 25. And this story of Nabal, Abigail, and David is a story of superlatives as we have been examining it. It is the story of the stupidest man in the Bible. And for those of you who were not here when we studied that lesson, I acknowledge that that's not a word that you ought to use, certainly not in the presence of your mother, but that if anyone deserves that appellation, it is clearly Nabal, who failed to appreciate the blessings that had been given to him by God, failed to appreciate the blessings of a good wife, failed to appreciate the protection that David had provided for him, failed to understand the disproportionate power between himself and David. And it is also the story of the wisest woman in the Bible, for clearly Abigail saves the day by her wise and gracious behavior, by her humble and gracious speech. And this evening I want us to consider, well, maybe one more, that is the oddest couple in the Bible, Abigail and Nabal, how they came to be together and how they dealt with one another. Would certainly be an interesting side story to this that is told in 1 Samuel chapter 25. But for tonight, I want us to consider the angriest man in the Bible. For it is David who is the central feature of this story, and it is David's anger that is principally dealt with in this passage. You'll remember, just as a quick review, that the story begins with the death of Samuel. And the death of Samuel is of more than just some chronological interest in this story, for it is a passing of a great and a good man, passing of a man that no doubt David had great confidence in, and that David felt probably represented his interest, had his interest at heart, certainly because he had God's interest at heart more than anyone else. It is no doubt with the passing of Samuel that David feels that he is in some ways now alone in his battle against Saul. And this has gone on for at least a few years by this point in time, that David has been anointed by Samuel to be the next king, and yet he has been displaced and pursued as an outlaw throughout the wilderness area, that he has been living among outlaws and with outlaws, and yet he has not become an outlaw over all this long period of time. And on this occasion, we see that he has lived in this wilderness area throughout the winter, and that he and his men, some 600 of them who have gathered around him, have served rather than taking advantage of the people around about them, they have served as protectors for those people. They have protected Nabal's shepherds and Nabal's sheep, and thus protected Nabal's wealth. It is now springtime, and it is the shearing time of the year, a time in which Nabal will count his wealth, and he is a wealthy man indeed. It is a time of feasting. It is a time of joy. It is a time of charity and goodwill. And so David sends a pleasant greeting to Nabal, a gracious request that at this point in the year that he recognize the benefit that he has received from David and his men and their protection. And to this, the shepherds agree that it has been all through the winter that David's men have been with them and have not taken advantage of them, but that instead they have served as a wall about them to protect them from the other dangers of the wilderness. But Nabal, being the fool that he is, sends back to David a harsh, a cruel, and a unpleasant and unjust response. He talks about David as if he is just some common outlaw or some common rebel, and despises the stories that he's heard about David being the anointed of God. And sending back this harsh response without any real kind of consideration about what David's response might be in return, he provokes David's anger. David explodes in anger at this response of Nabal. Now, in previous episodes in his life, even when he'd been wronged, David had exercised grace and wisdom. He is indeed a man after God's own heart. He had allowed Saul to go on living, even when he'd had him within his hand, right there in the cave where he and his men were hiding, and Saul had come in alone. He had him there in his hand, and his men urged him to take advantage of that and to kill him and to take his rightful place as king. But he had refused to do so on that occasion because he recognized that it would be wrong for him to raise his hand against God's anointed. And yet now on this occasion, we see him in a towering rage over an insult from a nothing kind of an individual like Nabal. And that really is our lesson for this evening, is the problem of anger. And we might begin by asking the question. And no need for a show of hands. Does anyone here have a problem with anger? And in fact, sometimes when I do this in my classes at school, I do have them raise their hand. Maybe not a question like that, but maybe turn the question around and ask it this way. Is there anyone here who does not have a problem with anger? And the answer for most of us is that anger is a part of the human nature, the human spirit, and it is something that we are urged, commanded even, to control because of the danger that it poses to us, the destruction that it brings not only to other people but to ourselves. Some anger is acceptable, as the Bible indicates there in that passage in Ephesians 4 and verse 26. Be angry and sin not. It is altogether possible for us to be angry and yet not to sin. I was a little bit amused when I said to Gary after the lesson this morning, you talk to them about hate, I'm going to talk to them about anger. And as Gary pointed out this morning in his lesson, there is some hatred that is not only right, it is called for. And yet we need to handle that kind of emotion in the appropriate fashion. So too, sometimes anger is called for. And yet we need to be very, very careful with these dangerous emotions because they are so corrosive and they so easily get out of containment. Too often is the fact, certainly with anger, that it controls us rather than we controlling it. One of the proverbs, of the many proverbs that have been cobbled together through history to point to the dangers of anger, one of those many proverbs says that a man in a rage rides a horse that runs away with him. And the passage in Ephesians chapter 4, it says, be angry and sin not, don't let the sun go down upon your wrath, suggests that anger is something that each and every one of us are going to experience. And that when we experience that anger, we need to control it rather than letting it control us. And in fact, it suggests something about how we ought to handle that anger, that it ought not to be long term. It ought not to persist more than the day. It certainly ought not to persist throughout our lifetime. And it should not lead us to do things that are sinful. We need to control it rather than letting it control us. But unfortunately, anger too frequently causes devastation and destruction on a scale that we never intended when we first were provoked and we first lashed out at other people. Anger is like fire. It finally dies out, but only after it has left a path of destruction. And every time I see one of those fires that they have so frequently in the western parts of the nation, where those fires just sweep through the dry wood out there, and you think this is what anger does. It flares up. And it starts with a small spark, it flares up, and then when it is gone, all burned out eventually, just look how much damage that it has done. And often, of course, the damage that anger does is more to the one who is angry than the one that we're angry at. One of the other proverbs about anger, which is so apt, says, anger is like a coal that someone picks up to throw at someone else. And when you pick up that hot coal to throw it at someone else, it is your hand that is burned and not the one that you intend to throw it at. Anger is probably more corrosive to the person who is angry than it is to the person that we are angry at. If, in fact, our intention, which it should not be, is to get revenge on another person, anger is not likely to make that happen. The Bible has a lot to say, of course, not just human proverbs, but the Bible has a lot to say about how we need to control our anger. Proverbs, of course, the book of Proverbs in the Bible is replete with comments about anger because it is so much a part of human nature. Proverbs chapter 14, one of the very familiar proverbs in the Bible about anger, Proverbs 14 and verse 29, "He who is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who is quick-tempered exalts folly. A tranquil heart is life to the body, but passion is rottenness to the bones." And sometimes we wonder why it is that God has given us this raging kind of emotion, passion, that we are so prone to. However that works out, whether that is a part of God's original creation or it's a part of that which has been tainted in us by sin, nonetheless, it is clear that those passions are dangerous to us when we don't control them and point them in the right direction. We need to be very careful about anger particularly. The New Testament points to the same kind of problem with anger that the Old Testament Proverbs do. Matthew chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has something to say about anger there. Amidst all the beatitudes and all the blessedness of life that he wants us to have, in Matthew chapter 5 verse 22, "I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court." And he goes on to talk about how that anger leading one from one step of attitude toward his brother to the next leads even into hell. Galatians chapter 5, where we have a description of the lust of the flesh. If you look at the description of the lust of the flesh, so many of those are things related to this issue of anger. Galatians chapter 5 and verse 20, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, outburst of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, all of those kind of things. There's this kind of set of sensuality kinds of sins, and there's this set of passion or anger kinds of sins, as well as the set of sins that are related to ambition and selfishness and self-centeredness. Anger clearly is a problem, and we see it displayed in David. Now, some of you have already been thinking about this, I am sure, and you're like, "I'm not sure David is the angriest man in the Bible." Well, maybe not. I don't know. There are some other good candidates, of course. There is Cain, the first man, I guess, that we recognize as his anger causing destruction. In Genesis chapter 4, you can read about how Cain was angry with his brother, and because he was angry with his brother, he killed him. Genesis 4 and verse 5, "Cain became very angry. His countenance fell. And then the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it.'" And obviously, Cain does not take the advice of God any more than most of us, when we're angry, take the advice of other people who try and warn us about what's going to happen. God says you can resolve this problem. And of course, the thing is, exactly why is it that Cain was angry? He was angry because his sacrifice had been rejected. And that's a hurtful thing. I don't think anybody would have had any objection to, or that God would have had any objection to Cain and his countenance falling when God says, I don't want your sacrifice. What he should have done, of course, was to have turned that feeling to a self-examination. And that's what God suggests to him. You need to master this anger. It's not your brother's fault that you're sacrifice was rejected. You need to try and figure out what the problem is. But he wants to get even with his brother because he blames his brother for his own mistake. Whatever was wrong with his sacrifice, that had nothing to do with Abel. We can always change ourselves. We can't change other people. We can't change what other people did. And his anger just ate away at him. And I don't know how long it was before he rose up and slew his brother, because he blamed his brother for his own shortcomings. We need to be really careful about that, because that's easy to do. Not only is it a problem when something doesn't go the way we want it to go, not only is it a problem when some way, you know, what we've done is rejected or it's not good enough, but it's hard to admit that it was our fault. It's easier to blame somebody else and to feel some kind of self-justification and our anger about another person. But that's not going to solve the problem, because the problem was with us, not with somebody else, not even really with the fruits of the field that Cain had brought to God. The problem was in him somehow, either in the fact that he was not doing exactly what God had told him to do, or his attitude wasn't right, but he was angry. And in his anger, he killed his brother. And, of course, his name remains then used in the New Testament as the name of people who hate their brother unjustly, the name of those who are murderers. Well, maybe he's the angriest man in the Bible. I don't know. What about Moses? Moses, of course, we think of as the humblest man in the Bible. But Moses got so angry on one occasion that he disobeyed God. And you know exactly the passage that I'm talking about in Numbers chapter 20. Beginning in verse 7, Numbers chapter 20, and in verse 7. Now, once again, Moses is being provoked pretty heavily by the Israelites. I mean, I'm telling you, you don't want to be like in charge of a bunch of people. Certainly not a bunch of people like this, because they're going to provoke you. And anybody who takes on a position of leadership, whether it is as a parent or as a teacher or as is a manager in a business, you better be prepared for people to provoke you, because that's what they do. And Moses, of course, is provoked beyond the ordinary, beyond just being the owner of a business, beyond just being a teacher in a classroom. Because these people are just, I mean, you go back and look at it and say, like, I don't know. I might have been with God. Let's just kill them all. Because they were pretty bad. But God says to Moses, I want you to go speak to the rock. And Moses takes his staff and strikes the rock. And it turns out that he is so angry that he disobeys God and hits the rock. Now, I've wanted to hit I have hit a lot of things in my life. Never a rock with a staff, I don't think, but I've hit a lot of things. But you know what? It doesn't really help very much. It certainly didn't help on this occasion. God went ahead and did the blessing that he was going to do for the people of Israel, because that's what he was going to do. But Moses, as a result of that, loses his place in the promised land. And in Numbers chapter 20 and verse 12, God says exactly the reason why he had this outburst of anger. Numbers 20 and verse 12, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you've not believed me. They didn't have enough faith to treat him as holy. Rather than fully trusting God to handle the situation, Moses takes all that responsibility to himself, and he takes matters into his own hand, and he tried to fix it himself. And you just can't do that. We're not capable of fixing much of anything. We're surely not capable of fixing other people. They are just going to be the way they are until something we say leads them to God and faith in God that then can change them, because they make up their own mind to do that. But angry words and striking rocks is not going to help the situation. Frustration is all that's going to ensue when we think that we have to do it all. We've got to trust God and believe in God. Well, Moses, maybe he's not the angriest man in the Bible. He's just this one occasion. But what about Balaam? Maybe Balaam is the angriest man in the Bible because he gets so angry he beats his donkey. Numbers chapter 22, you can read about Balaam. And of course, Balaam is just an all-around bad person. There's no doubt about that. Balaam is used in the condemnations in the New Testament of all of those people who pretend to be preachers, and yet at the same time, they're overwhelmed by greed. But not only is Balaam overwhelmed by greed, he's overwhelmed by anger too, because he's on his way to do something he ought not to do. And God sends an angel to stop him, but Balaam is so full of his own kind of greed and his own kind of determination, selfish ambition, he can't even see the angel, but the donkey does, and the donkey turns back. Three times the donkey turns back, and then Balaam beats the donkey. And then in Numbers chapter 22 and in verse 28, the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you struck me these three times?" And Balaam said to the donkey, "Because you made a mockery of me." And that, yeah, that'll make us angry, all right. But of course, it wasn't the donkey making a mockery of him. That's just the way he interpreted the situation, because he wasn't spiritual enough to see what was really in front of him there, that angel. And Balaam said to the donkey, "Because you made a mockery to me, if there had been a sword in my hand, I would have killed you by now." And the donkey said to Balaam, "Am I not your donkey in which you've ridden all your life to this day? Have I ever been accustomed to do so to you?" And he said, "No." And the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel, and the Lord was standing in the way with his sword drawn and in his hand, and he bowed all the way to the ground. And the angel of the Lord said to him, "Why have you struck your donkey these three times?" "Because I have come out as an adversary, because your way was contrary to me. But the donkey saw me and turned aside for these three times. If she'd not turned aside for me, I would surely have killed you just now and let her live." And it's like, you know, you can understand. You see people that get that angry and they hit the dog or they hit the donkey or whatever else happens to be in the way. The truth of the matter was there was an obstacle in his way, and that was what was frustrating Balaam, and he just took it out on the nearest thing, on the nearest living thing in this case. Actually, the hindrance in his path was a merciful obstacle from God, and yet he's too unspiritual to see that, and he's just angry, and he beats the donkey because of his anger. If he had been a little more spiritual-minded, he would have thanked the donkey for what the donkey had done for him. But he got angry, and he beat the donkey. We need to learn to trust God. We need to learn to think maybe sometimes the hindrances are there for a purpose for us to learn some kind of lesson from them. In fact, whether they are there deliberately by an angel standing in the way that we can't see or not, hindrances are always an opportunity to learn some kind of a lesson. Philippians chapter 4. That's the one you wanted to read, Steve, but I made you read Ephesians chapter 4. But in Philippians chapter 4 and in verse 6, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and petition with thanksgiving present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." We need to trust God, as opposed to trying to take care of all the obstacles ourselves and worrying about all of that to the point that we become angry and take it out on some poor, helpless donkey. Anybody here ever hit a donkey? Anybody here ever put their hands on a donkey? I don't know. But we have known this kind of anger, I am pretty sure. Well, Balaam, he might be a pretty good candidate for any bad superlative because he's just kind of a bad guy. But think about another man who may be the angriest man in the Bible, Ahab. Ahab in 1 Kings chapter 21. You remember when Ahab got angry, it was because Naboth wouldn't sell him his vineyard. And Ahab is like the king, and he's like used to controlling everything. And now Naboth won't give him his vineyard, and he gets angry. And what did he do? 1 Kings chapter 21 and verse 4. So Ahab came into his house sullen and vexed because of the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him. For he said, "I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers." And he lay down on his bed, and he turned away his face, and he ate no food. He was so angry that he couldn't even eat. Now, that to me is a candidate for one of the most angry men in the Bible. Because, you know, I get depressed, I eat. I get angry, I eat. I'm happy, I eat. You know, I'm sleepy, I eat. You know, it's just like, I don't understand that. But that's pretty angry when you're too angry to eat. He's very different, of course, than Jezebel, his wife. Jezebel gets angry. She just goes directly after the target, and she had Naboth killed. But this is an interesting thing about Ahab. He's so selfish and so self-centered that he felt he should be able to get whatever he wanted from anybody else. And when he didn't get it, he got angry. And then he started sulking. Once again, his problem is he doesn't have enough faith in God. He doesn't trust that God is going to give him what he needs and listen to what God's commands are. And he's angry, and now he can't even eat. Psalm 37 would have been an answer to the problems of Ahab. Psalm 37, and I wonder, does he have those psalms? You know, David had written those before this time, so I wonder. Psalm 37 and verse 5, commit your way to the Lord, trust in him, and he will do this. He will make your righteousness shine like the dawn, the justice of your cause like the noonday sun. Don't get angry. Depend on the Lord and put it in his hands, and if you're right, he will vindicate you. Well, I don't know. I got some more here. We're going to run out of time before I get through all the candidates here. Absalom, so angry, he waited 2 years to take his vengeance. But a vengeance, of course, is the explanation behind Absalom's anger. And it's his vengeance that not only kills his brother Amnon and separates him from the father, but it divides the whole kingdom. And anger and a seeking of revenge is never going to accomplish anything useful. Romans chapter 12. And verse 17, the principle by which we ought all to regulate our lives, and particularly when somebody is offended against us. Because if anybody in this list has a right to be angry, it probably is Absalom, because Amnon has raped his sister, and that's unconscionable and deserves some kind of punishment. And if anybody has the right to be angry, it's Absalom. But look what happens when he seeks his revenge, particularly in the way that he does. All the damage that creates. Romans 12 and verse 17. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody. If it's possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it's mine to avenge. I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. And in doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And I always used to read this, and I was like, man, that is like really good revenge. You know, be nice to them until they feel bad about it. What they don't all feel bad about that. I think it's a little bit of kind of maybe satire in this. But taking vengeance on other people may be satisfying for the moment. But look how much damage it is going to do. One more here, Jonah. Maybe Jonah was the angriest man in the Bible. He was so angry he wanted to die. You remember that God had sent him to preach to the Ninevites. And he tried to flee to Tarshish, and now we find out why he went to Tarshish instead of going to Nineveh to preach to them. Because when he preached to them, they repented. Can you imagine this, a preacher who is preaching to people, and he has the greatest response in the history of all the preachers of the Bible. The whole city of Nineveh, as wicked as those people are, they repented in sackcloth and ashes from the king right on down to the animals. And God turned his anger aside. And Jonah said, this is what I was worried about. This is exactly the reason I didn't want to come here. And he is angry. And he is so angry. He says in Jonah chapter 4, and let's see, which verse is this? Jonah 4 and verse 1, but it greatly displeased Jonah and he became angry, and he prayed to the Lord, and he said, please, Lord, was not this what I said when I was still in my own country? Therefore, in order to forestall this, as if God doesn't know what's best, I fled to Tarshish, for I knew that your gracious, compassionate God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, and the one who relents concerning calamity. Therefore now, O Lord, please take my life from me, for death is better to me than life. And God, of course, asked him, are you doing a good thing to be angry? I mean, angry is not good for anybody, but anger is especially bad in those people who claim to be a prophet for God, or those people who claim to be a preacher, an elder. I mean, they do more damage than they possibly could ever have done good with their preaching. And it is just amazing that Jonah was so effective as a preacher. Well, maybe, I don't know. But anyway, then he's angry about that. And God's disappointed clearly at Jonah's angry, and he makes him examine himself rather than condemning him outright and say, okay, death what you want, you can have death. No, he gave death to the gourd vine that grew up to shadow him and give him a little relief from the heat and the sun. And that wasn't the death that Jonah had asked for, but it was enough to make him ask the question, do you have the right to be angry about this thing? And of course, that's a question we ought to all ask ourselves, because the truth of the matter is, anger will kill you. Maybe not all at once, but it will kill us a little along. Mark Twain said, anger is an acid that does more harm to the vessel in which it is stored than to anything on which it is poured. Anger is just corrosive. And here's David, man after God's own heart. You would never list him in the category with these other people. And yet, in some ways, I think he is angrier than all of them. Previously, he'd controlled his temper. He'd controlled his attitude. Bad things had happened to him. Betrayals and misuse. His righteousness had not been rewarded. But there's no doubt that now he's under enormous stress with Samuel dead and all the difficulties that he's faced as an outlaw, all the sense that somehow this is all futile, maybe it was just a dream, it's not going to work out, I've been doing the right thing and look where I am now. Everybody else seems to be living a better life than I am as an outlaw here. Those are certainly times to try a man's soul. And everybody has their breaking point, and David is just about to reach his when he sends this gracious message to Nabal, a fool who is a rich man. It's like, that's just enough to make you angry anyway when you see somebody who's rich and they're like, can I say the word? Stupid. It just makes you upset. And then he like talks to David like David is a nothing and he's important. And David responds in just the way that you might have expected him to. Because you've been wronged by somebody before, and it's like, this is not right. It's just not right. And the more you think about how it's not right, the more not right it seems. And the more anger you feel about that, you need to say something in kind, or you need to beat a donkey or something. Just something. Usually what we do is we say something we're going to regret later. Anger manages everything badly. When you're angry, you're just not going to say the right thing. David encounters a man named Fool, which is what Nabal means, and he lives up to his name, and then he responds to this fool by foolishly going off into blind rage. And here's one of the things about anger. I mean, when we are angry, we don't control ourselves. We put ourselves in the control of some kind of mindless kind of emotion. In fact, in some way, you would say that David is temporarily insane. He leaves 200 of his men behind. I don't know why he did that. Maybe he still has a modicum of self-control. He takes 400 armed men, and he's going to go kill one fool. And worse than that, he's going to kill all the man's household because this man insulted him. Now, that's losing your mind. That's literally overkill. But that's the way David feels. He is like insane with his rage. Nabal is just an ant he can stomp. And that's what he's going to do, because nobody is going to talk to him that way. David is going to make him pay. And worse than that, he's going to kill Israelites. And what damage that would have done to the time when he becomes king, who knows? All the relatives of all the people that he'd killed would have found every excuse to have caused trouble. You just look what trouble was caused by sin with Bathsheba. It would have been terrifying. But he's saved by the wisest woman in the Bible, by Abigail, whose soft answer turns away anger. He is saved by her humility. Because when she meets David, she humbles herself at his feet. She refers to herself as his handmaid 6 times. She refers to him as Lord 14 times. She admits that he's in the right and that Nabal is a fool. Everybody knows that's the case, she says to him. But she asks for forgiveness. And she takes it on herself to ask for forgiveness and pleads with David to accept the best gift she's been able to put together at this point in time. And she tells him that David is center. Like the angel in the pathway of Balaam and his donkey, that God has sent her to turn him aside from this mission of vengeance. Else it will hang over his legacy like a dark cloud. She appeals to the spiritual side of David. And you can just imagine the struggle, because he is angry. He is angry enough to kill this man and all of his servants that he'd protected all through the winter. But Abigail's soft answer, her humility, and her appeal to his spiritual side turn his anger away, and it dissipates. And just quickly to sum up the lessons, even the angriest of men can be diverted from their anger if they're spiritual enough to listen to reason when it is presented to them, whether by their own heart and soul or whether by someone else who comes and speaks to them. That our faith and our reason can save us from anger's destructive power. Be angry and sin not, Proverbs 4 and verse 26 says. David trusted God. He had trusted him through all these other trials and tribulations. He would trust him now, as he's reminded by Abigail that he is God's chosen and that God is to be trusted. He always does things right. It doesn't matter how long it takes. Doesn't matter what injustices we suffer along the way. That he will be faithful. And we need to be faithful too. So really the question really for us is, if David could be this angry and could listen to a soft answer, could recognize humility when it was presented in front of him, could understand reason and appeals to his spiritual nature, then so ought we to be. Because none of us have been insulted like David was with Nabal. None of us, I hope, have been as angry as David was to take in hand a sword and to arm 400 other men to go on a campaign of vengeance. Whether David is the angriest man in the Bible or not, you may disagree with me. But I think we all have to admire the way in which David controls and handles that anger, as great as it was. And let that be a lesson for us. Well, you may be here this evening and you have some problem in your life that separates you from God. And every time we come together, we remind one another that the most important thing in our life is that we should have a relationship with God in which we have asked him for forgiveness and we have been forgiven through the blood of Jesus Christ. If you're here and there's something between you and God and you need to respond to his invitation, then we encourage you to do so as we stand and sing.